Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the June 6th broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Italian Tomatoes. It's Saturday night, June 6th, and the subject of our show tonight is Hillary Clinton for president, Donna Reed on steroids, and I'll explain the concept of the show in a couple of minutes. I do want to observe that today is the anniversary of D-Day, and of course, it's always appropriate to reflect on the tremendous sacrifices made for this country by the World War II generation, and, of course, on that incredible day of bravery and of sacrifice and of loss, which I think sometimes people forget about the loss that it entailed. The chat is open if you wish to participate in the chat and to call into the show. The number is 646-478-0004, and that number again is 646-478-0004. It's a weekend evening. Don't know how much live participation we'll have on the show, but people are certainly welcome to drop in and comment in the chat or call in if they are so inclined. Now, as far as the subject of the show, Hillary Clinton is a very contradictory figure, and to try to illustrate that, I kind of came up with the theme of juxtaposing her early life and her life and career path with a classic television show. You know, I think people's lives are, they can be explained by like the tree ring analogy, where a person's life is like a tree. Each distinct phase of their life, each period leaves a ring with a distinct marker. But unlike a tree, rings in people made by time don't often make a harmonious whole. They are contradictory and in conflict with each other. And that is certainly true with Hillary Clinton. In style and demeanor, she often evokes imagery and themes carried over from the America she grew up in. And that includes making a big emphasis on her roles as wife and mother and being concerned with children and community issues. But her life and political choices took her down a very different path, a very contradictory direction, often very unacknowledged by her. And the dichotomy, which I think is very obvious to outside observers, it seems to be not registering with her and causes no end of trouble for both her and those in her orbit as she accumulates money and political power. Now, to form the backdrop of the contrast between her formative years and the path that she took in life, I thought I would hit on the the Donna Reed Show, a classic television sitcom, very classy production, very well done, very wholesome. Donna Reed, in doing the research on the show, was a very highly thought of person by all the people that worked with her, and the show itself was a class act, very kind of radiating warmth and family values before family values got to be so politicized. And the role of a mother in the house, not a doormat, but a creative, strong person keeping the family together. And that's the kind of neighborhood, the neighborhood in the show, which is a Midwest neighborhood called Hilldale, is the kind of neighborhood Hillary Clinton grew up in suburban Chicago, and we'll go into the theme of suburbia. But first, kind of get in the mood, we'll launch the theme of the Donna Reed Show, which, of course, begins with a telephone call, and a telephone call, as we will see, played a great role in Hillary's later career. Famous theme show opening with that telephone call, and of course Hillary Clinton, as she pursued politics and power, eventually ran for president, as you may recall, in 2008. And one of the themes of her campaign that year was the 3 a.m. phone call, who was going to be the best qualified candidate, her or Barack Obama, to take those emergency calls that fall to the lot of any president when crises break out. Now, ironically, as Secretary of State, she did get just such a call, and the controversy surrounding how she responded to it is still an ongoing controversy. The Donna Reed Show, as I mentioned, took place in a neighborhood called Hilldale, which was exemplified Main Street, USA, located in the Midwest. Hillary, in the end, after they left the White House, settled in what I'll call Hillarydale, the exclusive suburb of Chappaqua, New York, which the exclusivity of it kind of shows the distance she traveled from her roots in the Midwest to the kind of elite life that she lives now on the East Coast. The suburbs where Hillary grew up and which were so vividly described in the Donna Reed Show, they had a very distinct lifestyle in the 50s and 60s. The homemaker role was very valued. The suburbs were a bedrock of the Republican Party of the day, which was a managerial and pro-business party primarily. A lot of the values issues that dominate Republican politics today hadn't surfaced yet, because the nation as a whole hadn't lurched left on social issues like it was to do in the 70s and then again during the past decade. It was accepted in the traditional suburb where Hillary grew up that the husband was a provider, and in the show, in the Donna Reed Show, the husband actually worked at home in a respectable profession, so it was a kind of the ideal family life situation. Well, when you look at the choices that Hillary took, I mean, she did opt to become a wife and mother, but then she also opted into a feminist agenda that really devalued the role of homemaker. In many cases, feminists consider that role to be either selling out for security or being victimized by men and patriarchy and all of that stuff. The suburbs, which were so reliably Republican in the 50s and 60s, have been trending more liberal and more democratic ever since. And that's exemplified by what happened in Illinois. Illinois in the 50s and 60s was a classic swing state where the Republican Party was a very viable contender for power. And of course, it has tilted very, very far to the Democratic side and to the left in the current political environment. Where I grew up on Long Island, when I was a kid, Long Island had several congressmen, and they were all Republicans, with the exception of one gentleman. His name was Lester Wolfe. 30 years later, the congressional delegation from Long Island was all Democrat, with the exception of one Republican, Steve King, who obviously, as Long Island became more liberal, had to tack into a very moderate direction and has made him an object of some controversy in the Republican Party. Like Donna Reed, Hillary, as they moved into middle age, her husband worked at home in politics, but oh my God, there is a very different, big difference between a politician of the stripe of Bill Clinton working at home and the respectable Dr. Stone in the Donna Reed television show. The Democratic Party, by the time the 80s and 90s rolled around, was really dominated by people with agendas who all wanted something, and it was a bit of a culture shock for Hillary, given how she grew up, to make the switch culturally to deal with the kind of constituencies that are so common in the Democratic Party. I wanted to remark that when she was growing up, Hillary, as a teenager, was a Republican, campaigned for Goldwater, campaigned for Nixon, was, you know, in her youthful days, was concerned about voting fraud and things like that. So that's kind of just such an interesting marker as to how far she moved. Okay, want to check my chat? See if anybody needs attention or the phone lines. Everything looks quiet. So I'll just continue with my theme here. And if you grow up in a, you know, the typical suburban milieu that Hillary grew up in, making the transition to Democratic politics is probably not an easy thing to do. I recall reading in the Kennedy biographies the amount of friction Jackie Kennedy had when it came to dealing with, you know, Jackie Kennedy being a society girl, and all of a sudden she's thrust into this marriage where her husband has a political career. And there were all these Boston Irish Pauls descending on the house, you know, the typical smoke-filled cigar set. And it's a huge adjustment to make. And I think that Hillary, you know, did try to make it, but I think she also wants to distance herself from it. And I think that tracks back to the dichotomy between how she was raised and the kind of life that she chose. When it came to going to college, back in the day of the Donna Reed Show, that was an option for women, but not a requirement for middle class and upper middle class women. It was really a choice. They could or they didn't have to, just depended. And if they did, they were very likely to land up in a conservative school like Wellesley, which is where Hillary wound up going as well. And the movie Mona Lisa Smile paints a very vivid picture of the traditional Wellesley of the early 50s. Of course, that all changed, and that began changing quite a bit in the 60s when Hillary left her teenage years and went to college. There was a big change in attitude that it was no longer a choice. It was a middle-class girl or upper-middle-class girl goes to college, and if she's aspirational, onto the Ivy League. And there was a change in emphasis from education for its own sake to education in preparation for a career. Now, some of the traditional attitudes still existed in the late 60s, but things were changing very rapidly. And once the 60s were over, as the full impact of the cultural changes of the 60s matured in the 70s, the universities really started to move left as radicalized boomer academics moved up the food chain. And Hillary's college career and her law school career and her immediate post-law school career with the Watergate Committee show steady, steady movement to the left and big government and anti-war activism and, you know, and feminism and the whole range of political issues where the Democratic Party lurched left in almost all areas of social policy. And to draw the contrast of that radicalizing atmosphere of her college and post-collegiate years, I'll play a clip from the Donna Reed Show where Donna is describing her daughter's first experience in going to college, and we're talking about two universes here. And then there is a song that was very, very popular when Hillary was in high school. Again, this is just at the cusp of the great 60s social transformation. Let me find my clip. There it is.
This is a souvenir of another trip. The very first time I drove Mary to college. Well, she wasn't very anxious to go. She just wanted to be a singer. But when she met all the other kids and found out she could do lots of singing in the glee club, she began to like the idea of going to college. I can still see her on the stage when the music started. Johnny Angel, Johnny Angel, Johnny Angel, Johnny Angel, you're an angel to me. Johnny Angel, how I love him. He's got something that I can't resist, but he doesn't even know that I. Johnny Angel, how I want him, how I tingle when he passes by. Every time he says hello, my heart begins to fly. I'm in heaven, I get carried away. I dream of him and me, and how it's gonna be. Other fellas call me up.
OK, Okay. Well, that was the musicals. That was typical of the musical scene is Hillary, when Hillary Clinton was in high school preparing to go to college, and by the time she got out of college, and especially that by the time she got out of graduate school, both the musical change, the musical scene, and the overall society had been transformed beyond recognition, and that process has been going on ever since. Now, I'm going to just digress a little bit and now go on to a very big theme in Hillary's life, because obviously in the Donna Reed type of era environment, raising a family and motherhood was a priority role for women. There were career women, but women had a choice. It was totally acceptable to prioritize family over career. A woman did not have to work and could focus on raising a family if that was what she was inclined to do. And according to the social values of the time, most women were inclined to do that. And they could afford to do that because a household could get by on one income. Environment, that state of mind, if you will, got hammered to pieces by various forces in the late 60s and 70s. Feminists obviously were on the warpath in the 70s during that radical first stages of the movement, and they really denigrated the role of homemaker, and they weren't too crazy about motherhood in many cases either. But there were also a lot of economic forces at work during the inflation and economic stagnation of the 70s. Working became a necessity for most middle-class households to maintain a middle-class lifestyle. And if they wanted an upper-class or upper-middle-class or affluent lifestyle, a working career woman became almost indispensable unless the husband was extraordinarily successful, which he did not have to be in the 50s and 60s. He just had to hold, you know, a steady, respectable job and do okay in it, and the family could afford a house in the suburbs and get by on one income. That went out the window in the 70s. And that continued in the 80s and 90s and to what we have today. Ordinary women are incredibly stressed for both time and money, and as they deal with an economy that's facing the pressure of immigration and then all of the government forces that produce an environment of stagnant wages. And this, I think, is a big factor in kind of some of the dichotomies that surfaced in Hillary Clinton, because with a declining amount of economic security, you can never have enough money. You can't rely on your husband to pull in enough money to keep the lifestyle that you want your family to have. So you become very, very obsessed with money. And that was certainly true with Hillary Clinton, who actually out-earned Bill Clinton for much of their married life. So Hillary never enjoyed the security of having a secure provider. And I think that reinforced her obsession with money, which started to have symptoms at a very early period in the marriage, starting with her cattle futures speculative trading. I think in the late 70s she did that. And then, of course, there was the Whitewater investment deals, which generated a huge amount of controversy. And then there were all of the things that went on in the White House where Bill Clinton and his campaign contributions and all of that, and then on to the economic controversies of the Clinton Foundation. And this is all rooted, I think that Hillary's involvement in this goes with her acceptance of a certain middle-class lifestyle, the kind that she grew up with, and how much more money it took to pay for it by the time she was moving into middle age. So I'm going to check my chat now and phone calls and see. I think my brother has called in, so I'll say hello to him. Hey, Phil, how are you doing?
Hi, Bob. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay. Just got home.
I don't know if you were on listening. I was describing Long Island back in the 50s and 60s, where it had mostly Republican congressmen, and how that switched over time and became mostly Democratic, as the suburbs indeed have been drifting Democratic for the past 20, 30 years. Anyway. Going back to, again, the contrast between how Hillary was formed, but the environment that she matured in. When it comes to styles, values, and money, the traditional suburbs emphasized an understated, demure, respectable lifestyle. They were affluent and managerial. The tone was set by a man in the gray flannel suit who had a stable career with one or two companies, and a pension plan and an expense account, earned a good living, but did not have to earn a fortune, because nice homes in the suburbs were relatively affordable. But when you move into, you know, Hillary land, if you're in the Democratic Party in the post-Kennedy era, and that's where you're making your career, the Democrats are obsessed with glamour, celebrity, and money. And, of course, that takes a lot more financial resources to move in those circles than it did to move in the traditional suburbs of Hillary's youth. So people are obsessed with their investment portfolios, their stock options, their 401ks, making a killing with executive compensation, the glamour careers of hedge fund manager, Wall Street mogul, Hollywood. Emphasis is make a pile of money and live large. And a lot of these people gravitated over time to those suburbs, and those, like the Chappaquas, where Hillary Clinton lives now. And those suburbs changed in their tone and demeanor very radically. Homes became astronomically expensive compared to what they used to be, and the amount of income necessary to maintain and live in them and to pay for the other attributes of an upper middle class or affluent lifestyle, the private schools and European vacations and second houses and all of that, the bill for that just kept going up and up and up and up. And I think having left behind the understated suburbia that she grew up in and opted for this very affluent lifestyle on the East Coast, which has a counterpart on the West Coast and in a few affluent areas in the middle of the country, I mean, that had a very radical change in the Hillary Clinton persona, and that has been following her throughout her political life. So I'm just going to make a few other comparisons, and then I'll see if anybody calls in or to chat, and then we'll wrap it up. Ethnicity is kind of interesting, too, because the suburbs of the 50s and 60s, very powerful white Anglo-Saxon Protestant influence, but in the suburbs that Hillary lives in now, that there is, they are much more culturally diverse, and there are a lot of people of different ethnic groups making a pile of money who can live in these suburbs, and the ethnic composition of those suburbs has been changing. So this is, again, a kind of disconnect for Hillary. Faith is another interesting thing, because she grew up in traditional mainline Protestant suburbia of the 50s and 60s, which there was a lot of value attached to the freedom of conscience and limited government, which is a very kind of legacy of Protestant culture in America. But with the changes of the 60s and 70s, some Protestant churches began to emphasize the social gospel, and that was particularly true of the Methodist tradition in which Hillary was raised, which has a long tradition of telling people what to do and kind of in-your-face moralizing. And if you look at the reputation of Methodism in English literature, that is a kind of interesting theme that runs through it. So Hillary opted for a kind of faith vehicle that is tailor-made for government intervention. Very interesting path that she traveled from how she began in suburban Chicago back in the early 60s and what she turned into as a wife of a president, a Democratic power broker, and now a possible two-time candidate for the presidency. And then the last thing I want to remark about is community. The traditional suburbs of the era that Hillary grew up in, and this was still true when I was growing up, there was a primacy of family. Government was in the suburbs. People tended to want government limited to basic functions and a limited role for the federal government. They did not want the government interfering in everything. But, of course, what was one of the major themes of Hillary's political messaging? It takes a village to raise a kid. That is so indicative of the sea change in cultural attitudes that took place with people like Hillary Clinton. And a village didn't mean, you know, the little community that you grew up in. It meant a comprehensive web of government intervention on the local, state, and federal level. Government is involved in everything, especially defining acceptable thought and behavior. And the federal government is getting involved in thought control to a degree that was simply inconceivable back in the day in the 50s and 60s. So I just want to sum up here. Hillary Clinton makes a big deal out of being a wife and mother and a traditional figure concerned with children and community issues. And that is a carryover of the legacy of her youth. I mean, she accepted, and I think legitimately accepted, those values. But she also makes a big deal of being a power broker, and that involves a lot of behavior that totally clashes with the first objective of that traditional value set. And having made that choice, she has all of these other issues. She needs a lot more in the area of material goods than the understated affluence of the suburbs she grew up in. In the traditional suburbs, the Donna Reed archetype, if you will, those families lived with limits defined by family, common sense, manners, and community. Hillary on steroids wants to have it all, and more of it. power, money, and control, but hang on to the deference that we used to pay to the Donna Reeds of that earlier time. And I think this is going to be the source of just tremendous controversy and pain if she becomes president, because it cannot be done in an office as powerful as the presidency. This dichotomy will cause no end of trouble for herself, her party, the nation, and us. And that's kind of my take on the Hillary Clinton presidency and why I wanted to use this the Donna Reed show to just to illustrate the distance that has been traveled by her from her early upbringing to what she represents now. And that's kind of the end. So, Phil, what's going on? Anything?
No, nothing at all.
Nothing? I haven't been looking at the news today. Don't know any big headlines.
Well, there's a Triple Crown winner today.
Oh, yeah, American Pharoah. Yeah.
American Pharoah won, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it, you know.
Well, that's good. I mean, if it's a quiet day, that is good. I remarked at the beginning of the show that it's the anniversary of D-Day, and, you know, there are obviously people posting remembrances and memorials about that today. I mean, it really, that was such an incredible thing when you come to think about it. Just the whole assaulting a continent.
You know, they had this, the History Channel has got that, they have one of their channels, it's called American Heroes Channel, used to be the military channel.
Uh-huh.
And they've been running a thing about a D-Day, and it's just amazing what went on that day.
Oh, I mean just the complexity and the risk and the violence and it's just, you know, it takes your breath away when you think about it. And Eisenhower, I think he wrote two addresses, one if it was a success and one if it was a failure. I mean, if you can imagine.
And it was very close to being a failure.
Yes,
you know?
It was.
Because everything that could go wrong went wrong. And, you know, the tanks weren't able to reach the beaches. The bombers, they were afraid that the bombers would actually bomb the invading force, so they had them wait an extra 5 seconds before dropping the bombs, so the bombs dropped all the way inland, you know, all those pillboxes and heavy fortifications weren't touched at all by the bombs. It was just one disaster after another, you know? And,
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems that I, you know, when we grew up was that the media of the day tended to portray the victory in World War II as like some inevitable thing. And I just, you know, think that they really didn't do justice to what a terrible uncertainty all of those people lived with, and the losses. I mean, the losses.
Well,
were
D-Day. I think it was 2,500 casualties in a relatively few hours on D-Day. A lot of casualties. I mean, that first wave, the first wave or two that hit the beach, horrific casualties.
Yeah, I mean, it was like this, the way a lot of, it was a very triumphalistic portrayal that it was inevitable and just sort of automatic. And I think that kind of got baked into the political thinking that has been transmitted down through the years up into our own day.
There's a parallel to Iraq.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say.
In this, okay? And you know, when you're on the threads, that's one of the big criticisms. You know, Bush didn't know what the hell he was doing. You know, the incompetency. And the thing is, all throughout, I mean, you know, World War II was not assured. Victory in World War II was not assured. I mean, it took them, I think it took them 4 weeks for the breakout to get it out of the hedgerow company, you know, the country over there.
That's right,
You know, I mean, if you look at Guadalcanal, if you look at Iwo Jima, if you look at Tarawa, if you look at Okinawa, if you look at Saipan, you know, they were supposed to be done in 5 days. You know, some of these battles raged 30 days, 45 days.
And I think that the commentators and of the time, not so much the historians, but the kind of, political messaging that got baked into World War II was that if it's a good war, everything is speedy and fast and assured. And it's like, no. It's war is a, you know, risky, dicey, terrible proposition. Things always go wrong. People, terrible tragedies occur. People get killed who shouldn't get killed. Tremendous waste, even if you win.
Even if you win. You know, there's a saying in sports, you know, the other team gets played, they get paid also. They get paid to win, you know. I mean, the corollary is the same thing in war. You're facing a professional army. You're facing a professionally trained army, you know? There are no gimmies in this.
No, I mean, even after they broke out and they, you know, liberated Paris and then moved on, then there was the, the Battle of the Bulge, which turned into...
Well, I was just going to bring that up. Yeah, I mean, you
almost
know...
Almost a near catastrophe. And, you know, Hitler... And then, of course, the other thing was, you know, racing the clock, because Hitler kept developing, you know, in the shrinking German empire, they were feverishly developing more and more weapons. You know, the V2s and God knows what else might have been developed. And, you know, they were desperate to get to the launching pads before he unleashed another reign of terror on London. And then this is where I really fault the political left, because in their politicization of the Iraq war, they distorted the perception of all war. War is nasty and risky and uncertain.
Well, you know, they think it's Call of Duty, you know, too.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And you respawn, you know.
Yeah,
and,
you know, I sometimes I see these videos on YouTube is big, where people put videos up of their performance in these games.
Yeah.
I'm thinking this is, you know, I'm sure it's very entertaining to do that, to play those games, but that gives you a totally warped idea of what war is. you know, this computer simulation of it, you know, just obscures the pain and the loss and the risk. And like you say, you know, you press rewind and you live to fight another day. I mean,
you live to fight another day.
Real thing is not like that. And there is some, score tracker. Well, the real thing isn't like that either.
You know, one of the biggest battles or one of the biggest victories of World War II was the Battle of Midway. That was a lucky fluke.
Yeah.
Because they found the Japanese carriers, you know, before they found the American carriers. That was a fluke.
There's so much chance in war. There really is. And, you know, when you make the decision to go to war, you cannot make the decision that, you cannot make the assumption that, oh, well, if you're competent and your cause is right, everything is going to be okay.
Well, that's one of the biggest misrepresentations of war.
That's how the left, you know, that's the line that they took with Iraq. And, of course, you know, now that they've had their way in the evolution of policy in that country, you know, now they are feverishly manufacturing excuses. Very, you know, interesting stuff. But, you know, D-Day, just, again, incredible event.
You know,
and like you said, I mean, all of the big World War II battles were like that. I guess D-Day maybe captures a little bit more of our imagination than that because of the contrast of what was being attempted, you know, not invading an island, but invading a continent.
And you know what? I forget the guy's name, but he was one of the captains of one of the destroyers over there. He saw what was happening. He saw how badly the troops were pinned down. And he really defied orders, and he brought his destroyer group in close to shore. If he didn't do that, they might have been pushed back off the beach.
Pushed back into the sea.
Into the sea.
I just shake my head sometimes when I hear the rhetoric that it's usually the left that they use when discussing war. They do not have a clue.
And this was, you know what, you have to understand, the other thing is, you know, World War II, I mean, that battle was planned for years. You know, that the invasion, the Normandy invasion, that thing was planned, you know, they did this, they did that, they did this, and it's still, with all the planning and everything else, it still almost failed.
Yeah, there are so many surprises. There are so many risks. There are so many things that some of them break your way. Some of them break against you. But whichever way they break, your battle plans get obsolete within hours. Maybe
well, you know, the first wave of paratroopers that went in, they were scattered all over the countryside. So within 2 hours, everything was already shot to hell.
Yeah. I don't know. It was sobering amount. You know, whenever these anniversaries roll around, it's just a sobering moment for reflection.
You know what? What's amazing to me is, I mean, there are a lot of these interviews that they have with these veterans who landed on Normandy and who went through and survived the Battle of the Bulge, you know, Iwo Jima, Guadalcanal. I mean, just their recollections are just, you know, they're chilling of what they went through.
Yeah. And they, you know, and for many years after, they never talked about it.
They never talked about it. And there's just a certain character that these people had. It's a bygone day. It's a bygone era. I don't know. I don't know if that character exists in this country anymore.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think it does with the military.
Well, with the military it does, yes. It does with the military.
I think that the public, you know, contrasted with the American public of 60 years ago or 70 years ago, you know, even though people have much more education now and they have computers and they have this and they have that, their perspective isn't as realistic as it was or as determined as it was from that generation in the, you know, in the 1940s, who, you know, they accepted it. They, you know, they didn't like it and they, you know, they grieved over it, but they accepted it as a cost, as a consequence of the decision that was made to declare war on Japan and Germany. They weren't always second guessing that if only the leadership was different, you know, not FDR lied and people died.
I think that that caused problems in Iraq anyway. I think that gave the insurgency a certain kind of, it steeled them up, you know. It gave them a resolve.
Well, it gives, you know, if you see, you have to make an evaluation about how much risk you're going to take. And if you see the war is a controversial thing in America, and if you know, if you know, your common sense is telling you, hey, if I wait it out, they will go home, and then I can do what I want and take over this country again. And that's, I think, what, you know, that's the decision those insurgents made. Now, well, you know, when the surge succeeded, they had to pull in their horns. But once the minute Obama came and started sending all those signals, it was like, okay, guys, now we regroup and we strike.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what happened.
We build up for a couple of years, and he's going to give it to us on a silver platter, and that's what happened. It's, you know, a terror, shame. Shame, shame, shame.
And the narrative is, of course, as always, it was Bush's fault.
Bush's fault. Well, I mean, you know, the show is about Hillary Clinton. She voted for this war, and then she just, like, backed away from it, as did many of the other Democrats who voted for it. It was like, oh, well, we were misled, and it was improperly executed, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, no war is properly executed. They just saw an opportunity to score political points, and they scored them. But, you know, Hillary is kind of trapped by that, the war vote, and then walking away from the war vote, and then sort of pushing for more interventions later when she became Secretary of State in Libya and in Syria. Well, not serious, it wasn't quite as pronounced, but Libya certainly was. And, like, the left, which at least is consistently anti-war, just does not trust her. They do not trust her. I don't know. That we're going to be in desperate need of therapy as a country if she becomes president, because I just think she's going to have a terrible time trying to hold it all together. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
No. Oh, okay. The silence.
The thought of her becoming president is a chilling thought.
Well, you know, kind of harking back to the theme of the show. I mean, I really think she has a split personality, because she wants to be this, you know, power broker player, but she has this enormous sense of entitlement, as if she were, you know, some great mother figure that you should defer to. It's like, no, lady, it's one or the other. You can't have both. It's like, how dare you question my motives? How dare you question all of these things in my past, which are, you know, very controversial and downright sleazy? I'm respectable Hillary Clinton. I'm for children and families.
I'm a grandmother, you know.
I'm a grandmother.
I'm a grandmother, I know.
And, like, you know, Barack Obama was bad enough because of, you know, his shtick as being, oh, I'm going to help America transcend its racial problems, so I'm above criticism, no matter how disastrous my policies and record is. I mean well, so I have done well. Well, Hillary is doing the same thing. Well, Camille Paley is. She had a great phrase for that. She says that whenever Hillary is in trouble, she turns on the estrogen light, which I think is just a great way of putting it. And, you know, on your way up, maybe you can play that game, but when you're president of the United States, like Harry Truman said, the buck stops there.
The buck stops here.
Yeah, she is not going to, I mean, if she tries to pull that crap, there are going to be very bad consequences for both her and the country. And that's what, you know, concerns me so much about her presidency, or potential presidency. Although the thing that, I didn't emphasize it in the show, it might be a theme for another show, is the generational question is also going to be very big in this coming race.
I really don't. I mean, everything I read is she doesn't really poll well, especially with the millennial generation. And she doesn't poll well with millennial women. And basically, the last poll is that she's only plus four with the whole women demographic anyway. So, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be very interesting because I don't know. I mean, if I can't see anybody else beating her for the nomination, but she's not going to be the game changer that Obama was. Oh, and by the way, we're about ready to go into the after show. So the recording will cut off. For anybody who's listening live, unless they call in, which I don't expect anybody to do on a Saturday night. But the demographics are very interesting because of a lot of women, younger women, simply cannot relate to her, no matter how much feminism she spouts.
No, they cannot.
They have a different. They just have a different. They've been competing in this economy, and she hasn't been. She's been living off of leverage and connections in a way that is very alien to younger men and younger women in this, you know, economy. You know, I thought it was so interesting that they went after the New York Times did that hit piece on Rubio and his traffic tickets, or more accurately, his wife's traffic tickets. But Hillary hasn't driven a car in 20 years.
Hillary hasn't driven a car. And you know what? There was another... there's a blog called Godfather Politics. It's a conservative blog. And they came up with a piece. Barack Obama had 17 unpaid parking tickets that he paid, I guess, just before he ran for presidency or something.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
And who else had parking tickets? And Kennedy had, Ted Kennedy had 51 citations.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, to go after a guy's, I mean, it's desperation.
It's desperation, but it also shows the degree to which the media is in the tank for the Democrats. Because when
well,
you know,
it all, yeah, it also shows the degree that they're going to dig.
Well, the Times was accused of using a Democratic opposition research specialist to get that information. And the Times defended itself, saying, oh, no, we didn't. We polled it ourselves. I don't think they realize that makes them look worse.
Yeah.
Because if somebody fed the story to them, well, it's like, okay, we got the story. We're going to run it. But if you make the decision to go into this trivial issue and invest your own time, you're really working for the Democrats. Whereas if you're not doing that to Hillary Clinton, and God knows what would crawl out from under the rocks if you lifted one of those up, I mean, you've made your bias, you've gone beyond bias. You're just part of the campaign annex. So, interesting stuff. Oh, well, I guess it's time to call it an evening. But thanks for calling in.
All right, Bob.
And to anybody who's listening to Archive, we'll be doing, when the debates start up, we'll be doing live coverage of any debate. The cast of thousands at this point. So stay on the lookout, and we'll be back. Have a great evening, everyone.
All right, take care, Bob.
Bye.